After covering the Vietnam War in the mid-60s for the Washington Post, Ward just says he lost interest in day-to-day political reporting, so he turned to fiction. Since 1970, he's written 10 novels, several drawing on his years spent in Washington. His new novel, Jack Gantz, is set in the political arena of the 60s and 70s. The story follows Jack's rise in politics from Chicago ward politics to the U.S. Senate. In his review of Jack Gantz, our book critic John Leonard said that he couldn't think of another writer of Ward Just's quality who has made it his artistic business to imagine the whys and wherefores of the morality of politics. These days, Ward Just spends most of his time living in Paris. I asked him if he follows the ins and outs of Washington politics from France.
I will go, you know, days sometimes and never read anything that comes out of Washington, in part because most of it's so repetitive. I mean, rarely do you actually find something, except that as a citizen, you want to know, you want to know what George Bush's cabinet appointments are. I want to know that as a citizen. It has no implications for my writing life.
So you can write about characters in the 70s and the 80s, as well as in the 50s and 60s, and find that, for the most part, that'll work. You know enough about Washington to get the facts right.
I think so. You try to get the streets correct, and you try not to, to have somebody in Georgetown on the wrong side of the river. But that's really all you need. There isn't any. My book, Jack Gantz, for example, there isn't a fact in a carload in there. I think I've got somebody at one point sitting on the sixth floor of the executive office building, sort of looking down into the Rose Garden, and I was checking with somebody if that was actually true, and the guy said he thought it was, but he'd call up Washington to check, and I said, "Oh, don't bother," because it doesn't matter if you take the premise of Gantz and you're reading and you get that far. It's about halfway through the book, and you all of a sudden find a guy on the sixth floor, and you happen to know that you can't see the Rose Garden from the sixth floor. You're going to read right over that. You ought to. I mean, if the novel should create a strong enough mise en scène of its own, I mean, a strong enough ambiance of its own, that once you get in it, you'll take any so-called fact or detail for what it is and not relate it to whether or not it is objectively true. In other words, if Jack sees it, it's true.
Right. And that is a change from your work as a correspondent for Newsweek.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It's 180 degrees.
Yeah. Well, you have a description of Washington that describes both, I think, the political culture and the intersection with personal lives in a very nice way in Jack Gantz.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could read a bit to us of this.
Indeed. Besieged, we came to resemble the corporate world we had despised and derided. The city grew, the culture thickened, and the custodians multiplied, the government floating on a sea of debt. The world owed Washington a living. The film advanced, the reel accelerated, and in a minute I was in middle age, successful and conspicuous, a president's man. My minute. A congressman passed me along to a senator, an insider's insider, so thoroughly a product of the Senate committee system that he was nicknamed the Camel. I commenced an affair with the Camel's wife, a woman 10 years younger than her husband, who understood the city's routine and understood also the Camel's fierce enthusiasm for it. The Camel wanted to be a chairman, and that was all he wanted. Their married life had suffered, obviously. The Camel wanted one thing and she wanted something else, but that was often the case with two highly motivated people in a cautious, acquisitive city. She was a witty woman, filled with gaiety and rich. Her money had financed the Camel's political career. She was proud of that and proud of him. She was accustomed to having things her own way, and in that she was accommodated by her husband and the city's strange twilight mood. The affair flourished and we talked of marriage, but she would not leave him. She had put so much into their marriage, and he needed her. And what are your prospects, Jack?
A lot of your Washington novels have a sense of ordinariness about them. I mean, in other words, there's no sort of 7 days in May sort of crises that evolves. But they tend to have more sort of lubricious deal-makings, behind-the-scenes action. From your experience as a reporter there in Washington, as an editorial writer for the Washington Post, is this your sense of what really goes on? There's just sort of an accretion of events?
What's interesting in Washington is the language that they use, and the language that they use not in press conferences but to each other. And it is always, or nearly always, a language of indirection. And if you are, to my mind, to get at Washington, no less than you'd try to get at political life in Philadelphia or commercial life in Paris or Detroit or Chicago. What gets to the heart of the life of a city are the more daily things.
You talked about this language of indirection that goes on. As a novelist, you need to have a great deal of precision in the sense of recording your own images and ideas. How do you cope with this issue of dealing with people who live and thrive on indirectness, yet you have to set forth a story that is direct and
yeah, clear? It's technically the most difficult thing about trying to write a book about people who live part of their lives in the public glare. Because, I mean, just in choosing your characters, this has to be done very carefully so that the minute you wheel somebody on stage, that immediately they say, oh, that's, he's talking about Kissinger there, he's talking about George Bush someplace else or some congressman or senator. And once that happens, the novel will fall as if you'd put a 500-pound dead weight in it. It'll absolutely sink from sight. But the minute you try to step over, the minute that you must, what I'm trying to say is you must create your own characters. You cannot find these characters on the front page of the daily newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You worked as a foreign correspondent. That was almost your first job in journalism, as I recall. And you were sent off to various parts throughout the Caribbean. Somebody told a story that when you were in the Dominican Republic to verify that Trujillo was as nasty as everyone said, that you actually dug up bodies in a mass grave to prove that?
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't thought about that story in years. It was true. I was tipped off. And I was tipped. A man said, if you go to a bridge and gave the coordinates of the bridge and you dig, you're going to find dead people there. And it was a slow news day. So I went with a friend of mine. We got him, rented a car, and drove out to this bridge and started digging. And it's true, there they were. You really bring that back. I hadn't thought about that in years and years and years, but it's true. They called me a hard-digging reporter after that.
Gee.
I know. Couldn't resist.
There was but there was another time in your life when you were sent to Vietnam by the Washington Post from 65 to 67 that was... had a little more effect on you. You've said it roiled your waters. What does that mean?
I used to sort of give an explanation that had to do with facts and illusions and all that nonsense. And all that's partly true too. But what it really was a passage. I was one of those people. I fit into the war in Vietnam. It was the sort of war that I was able to cover. I don't know why I was able to plug into the particular craziness of it somehow. I mean, maybe because I think my strength as a reporter was always, I had a particularly good sense of ambiguity. And at the time that I was there, 66 and 67, the war was rich in ambiguity. And if you had a touch for that, and also a little sense of irony and paradox, there was more than you can ever write.
One last question here, if I could. You're the son and grandson of newspaper publishers, and you've also worked as a reporter yourself. How do you think they'd view your life, having sort of abandoned the daily-day pressures of newspaper business? You think they'd say, terrific, Ward, you did exactly what we'd always hoped to do?
A very interesting question, and I think that they would absolutely have preferred me to stay in the newspaper business. I think there is no doubt about that.
Was it their attitudes about fiction or the writer's life?
No, their attitude was about the newspaper that they owned, which they absolutely loved like they loved a child. And I still occasionally see them shaking their finger at me, saying, why have you done this terrible thing to go off and write these novels when you could be sitting in Waukegan, Illinois, publishing a newspaper? And it's given me a thought or two, over the years. Not such a large thought as to make me really basically question the decision of what I did, but it's true, you have a kind of a family tradition like that, and it always has a meaning to you.